Hello, and welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation, the podcast segment of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, artists, musicians, filmmakers, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture, because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Well, hello again, everybody. It's been quite a while since we last had one of these baseball conversations. I'm employed in a new line of work now with new hours, which have curtailed a lot of my extracurricular activities, such as reading and writing and blogging and podcasting. So hope now that I've settled in a little bit, I'll be able to get back to the things I've enjoyed doing and hopefully you've enjoyed. So without further ado, today's guest was recorded late last year, which shows how long it's been since I've had a chance to do these things. It is Rich Cohen, the author of the Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse, one of a slew of books that was written after the Cubs won their first championship in over 100 years. And rightly so, that this phenomenon should get as much attention as it had. It's led to a slew of books about the Cubs. There have always been a bunch of books about the clubs, but it's usually been about the disappointment of the Cubs and the curse of the Cubs. So this story of a curse is a little bit different. It's a very personal story, one I enjoyed very much, and I enjoyed talking with Rich Cohen about this. Rich Cohen is the author of several New York Times bestsellers, including Tough Jews, The Avengers, Monsters, and When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. He is co-creator of the HBO series Vinyl and a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone. He has also written for The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and Harper's Magazine, among others, and he's won numerous awards, including the Great Lakes Book Award, the Chicago Public Library's 21st Century Award, and ASCAP's Deems Taylor Award for Outstanding Coverage of Music. And it was my great pleasure to talk with him about his latest effort. Rich Cohen, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
So, when the Red Sox won the series after not having won the series for generations, there was a slew of books published. And when the Cubs won, after generations of not having won, a slew of books were published. So would you say we have Theo Epstein to thank for his contributions to baseball literature?
I guess he gave the occasion, but basically, if the book is published just for that reason, it's probably not a very good book. So you can thank him for one truly great book, mine.
So what was the genesis of your book?
I've been kind of writing it for years. I mean, I did this big, long story for Harper's Magazine in 2000 when I traveled with the Cubs and tried to figure out why they couldn't win. I wrote this piece in Wall Street Journal called Why Wrigley Field Must Be Destroyed. That was like 7 years ago. So I feel like I've been doing the chapters bit by bit because the Cubs were always such a big part of my life. And the fact of them not winning was always so much what it meant to be a Cubs fan. And then when they won, and I even write a story that, you know, anticipating this happening several times, it gave you an ending to the story and it allowed you to see Cubs history as what it was, which is the epic of American sport, as far as I'm concerned. And also it was represented a new era because what being a Cubs fan meant had changed, so there was a kind of a melancholiness to it. As far as the Red Sox goes, I know about their curse and the curse of the Bambino, but I always looked at it as kind of the Red Sox as kind of a minor league curse because the Red Sox were often very good. They got to the World Series. They just lost in the World Series, or they happened to be in the same league as the Yankees, who are the best team in history. The Cubs were terrible. And even in 1918, when the Red Sox last won, I'd always say, they haven't won since 1918, huh? Who did they beat? Well, they beat the Cubs with Babe Ruth pitching. So I believe that, you know, the Red Sox and the Cubs are really interlinked. Their whole histories are. So
sure.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things you write about, which I found very interesting, you write about Moses leading the Israelites out of Egypt to wander through the desert for 40 years. And you wonder why it took so long, given the geographic proximity of where they were going to from where they were. Now, supposedly it was God's way of cleansing the generation that had sinned by creating false idols. So my question is, do you think that there's something to the cleansing of generations of doubting Cubs fans as one of the reasons this took so long?
Well, I came to think so, you know, when I 2015, when they got started to look really good, I got Sports Illustrated to send me just to spend a week in the bleachers to see what it was like if things had changed. Because that's where I grew up, kind of going to the bleachers at Wrigley Field. And I noticed, first of all, people were much younger. I'd always been the youngest guy out there when I was a kid. Now I was like the oldest. And they had a completely different attitude, which is they actually expected to win. And when the Cubs fell behind, they would start cheering like people in other cities, like the kind of cities where they do the wave, as if they expected something good to happen. And that was completely contrary to my image of a Cubs fan, which had always been, even when we're winning, we're looking for the way that we're going to lose. And usually that is what would happen. And that's, I had the realization about the Bible story, which is, you know, not just, I always thought it's not just cleansing of the sin, but kind of the dying out of the slave generation, you know, that has the mentality, the slave mentality. And there was kind of, I do think that there was an approach by Theo Epstein, I mean, I'm overdoing it a little bit, but, which is, it's not only the players and the attitude on the team needs to change, the attitude among the fans needed to change. And, So you have these young fans like my own kids who are completely different. And my big realization was that I was a member of that slave generation, that I would never really get there, even when the Cubs won the World Series, if they did, because the wilderness was already inside me.
Now you're right about, I believe your dad did not want you to be a Cubs fan because of the disappointment you would no doubt encounter. You don't have that. How old are your kids?
14, 13, 10, and 2.
Okay, so you have no worries about their
no,
future
fans?
No, it
wasn't. It's my dad. It makes my dad sound far too kind to say that he was just worried about my disappointment. He could give a crap about my disappointment. And when I was a kid, I used to go to him and say, I'm unhappy. And he'd say, good. This happiness breeds progress. Happy people have never done anything. Okay, so basically what he said is a Cubs fan will be less successful. Because a Cubs fan expects all human endeavor to end in defeat and will expect that to happen and will lower his expectations and thereby achieve less. So I think being a Cubs fan, conversely, turned me into a writer because it gave me like a tragic sensibility. As for my kids, no, they're growing up in a completely different world because in their world, you know, the Cubs, they're fans for like 2 years and the Cubs won the World Series. And they've even more than won the World Series in a way. They've been to three straight National League Championship Series. Unheard of. The Cubs had not made repeat playoff appearances like that since 1906, 1907, 1908. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about it, from my point of view as a kid, is it wasn't just the Cubs. No Chicago team won in my childhood. The Bears had won in 63. And the Bears won again in 85. And between those 2 years, no Chicago team, other than the Chicago Sting of the Indoor Soccer League, won a championship.
Now you talk about expectations. I'm guessing you might be familiar with Billy Lowe, a pitcher for the Brooklyn Dodgers, won 19 games 1 year, and he was asked about winning 20, and he said he didn't want to win 20, and they said, why not? And he said, well, then they'll expect me to do it every year. Do you think this generation of Cubs fans, like your kids, are going to expect them to win every year, and what happens if they don't?
I do think that they will expect it. They become normal, healthy sports fans. So part of the distinction of being a Cubs fan was we didn't expect it, and in some way, ultimately, we felt like we wanted it, but we didn't need it. You know, I always said that, you know, you're a Cubs fan, you're like the Buddhist of the game because you sort of have escaped the wheel of profit and loss. We know we've given that up. We've given up ambition. And thereby we can just sit there and enjoy the baseball game for when it is and what it is without thinking what it means, you know. And that was something that I always worried would change about being a Cubs fan. And it has changed. And, you know, it becomes being a Cubs fan. And Red Sox fans have taken me aside and said this is absolutely what happened to Red Sox fans, which is it just becomes, you know, ordinary in a way. Like you become like a normal, healthy citizen of the world. So, yeah, I do think, and even this year, the Cubs went all the way to the NLCS. They lost, okay. I mean, they ran out of gas, but they had a great season. And it looked like in the middle of the season, like they weren't even going to make the playoffs, and they had this 11-game swing. And they overperformed, as far as I'm concerned. and they lost to a team that had this unbelievable team with this great record, and people are now, like, pissed off. And I'm like, listen, we got to have at least 3 years of just being grateful before we can become like every other fan.
But do you think that because of these expectations... What am I trying to say? And by the way, that line you had about the being the Buddhist fans, I thought was fantastic. It was like the expectations and the way the Cubs are succeeding now, they are no longer I know you probably hate the term lovable losers, but when they were the lovable losers, there was rahmanis, that there was empathy for them, for what they went through, and for what more for what their fans went through. Because as you're right, the Cubs are really a terrible team, and management didn't seem to have any real interest for a long time in making them a good team.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this year something that surprised me just was that people were hating on the Cubs.
Mm-hmm.
And no one ever hated on the Cubs before, you know? And then you realize, oh, that's because that's what happens when you're good. You know, before, Cubs were like everybody in the country's second favorite team was the Cubs.
Right.
Yeah, because they hadn't won in so long, it's a great story, and because they're no threat to anybody. They're not going to beat you in a pennant race. You don't have to worry about them. But now that goes with being, you know, successful is you become hated in some way.
Well,
so,
that's like when
yeah.
the Red Sox started winning. You know, it used to be that the Yankees were the most hated team in baseball because they always won. And then Boston started winning, and they developed this reputation of smugness and superiority. And then maybe is that it might be happening with Cubs fans now?
Yeah, I don't see it happening on an individual level of the fans, but I could see why the team that wins beats your team. And you hate that team.
Mm-hmm.
And the fans that are cheering the team that wins is cheering against your team. Mm-hmm. And they will seem arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I felt that way watching the Dodgers. Now, I'm 49 years old or whatever. I'm a grown-up, and I know that this is baseball, and these people are excited about their team. But when a home run is hit by the other team in a Dodger Stadium, they all cheer. It's like they're stomping on me. That's how it always feels. So the team that's good is hated. The Yankees were the most hated because the Yankees were the best. You know, and basically you get to be an underdog and have that sympathy right up until you win, and then it goes away.
Now, I think my favorite part of the book was the early history of the team, where you write about the teams, of the championship teams of the 1906 to 1908, and even you know, moving forward up until the part where Philip Wrigley took over the team. And as you say, you wrote that article about why the Wrigley Field must be destroyed. These guys are playing in Wrigley Field now. It's the same team. Well, the field wasn't changed, right? It was just the stadium was changed.
Right. Well, so my argument was, and it wasn't an argument that I invented. I was shocked by it, you know. I'm a devotee of Wrigley Field, too. But when I talked to, I think it's Larry McPhail. I always mix it up because there's so many McPhails. But it's, you know, the McPhail who was the GM of the Cubs in the early 2000s and won two World Series, I think, with Minnesota and the Kirby Puckett team.
Was and that Andrew?
Part of, maybe it's Andy McPhail. Yeah, I think you're right. But it's baseball royalty, you know. It's the McPhails
right.
who brought the night games to baseball mm-hmm. and did everything else that they did. And I said, why can't this team win? And I understood it when Wrigley was, owned the team. And Wrigley did a lot of bad things. But when the Tribune took over, we all expected them to win because they had money now. And they spent a lot of money, and they went out and they got great players, and they bring in great people like Dusty Baker, you know. And he said, you're going to hate this answer, but it's Wrigley Field. And he explained it. He said, Wrigley Field is, he said, think about it. The Cubs are the best team in baseball. They were the Yankees for the first era of the game, right up until they moved into Wrigley Field in whatever year it was, 1916, I think. And they never won another World Series. And, in fact, the only team to ever win in Wrigley Field was the 63 Mike Ditka Chicago Bears. He said the reason is the park is schizophrenic. The wind blows out right off the lake, and if it's blowing in, it's a pitcher's park. Nobody can hit it out. If it's blowing towards the lake, it's a hitter's park, and no pitcher can keep it in. So you virtually have no home field advantage. You don't have anything to build around, like the Yankees do with the short porch or the Red Sox do with the green wall, you know, the big green monster. And so you kind of need to build this all-around team that has pitching and hitting, and that's like an all-star team, and that's very hard to do. And that's what he said was the reason. And I was attacked for that, for writing that, you know, viciously right up until about a week after in being attacked, Kerry Wood retired. Remember Kerry Wood, mm-hmm. the great pitcher? And they said, why can't the Cubs win? And he said, it's Wrigley Field. And then the attacks just sort of stopped. And now it's become kind of a conventional thing. And, of course, the fact that they won Wrigley Field proves me wrong, except they've changed Wrigley Field. If you go there, it's not that the playing surface has been changed. The main thing is they built out the bleachers, okay, and they put in these huge scoreboards, like TV screens. Mm-hmm. It used to be that Wrigley Field was open. There was a cut through, like an alley. It was the bleachers weren't connected to the rest of the stadium, and the wind would whip through that alley. They put huge scoreboards that enclosed the stadium. My father used to say that Wrigley Field reminded him of Ebbets Field, except Ebbets Field was enclosed. Well, now if you go to Wrigley, it feels very enclosed. So what that did was that changed the wind pattern, and I think it, you know, it's still schizophrenic, but it's like a schizophrenic on lithium now. I mean, it's tamed it to the point that you can build some kind of stable pitching staff.
Which they've done, you know, to their credit. You know, Epstein has gone out. He's got the right people for the times to be playing here, and it seems like a very cohesive group of people that are enjoying playing with each other, unlike the teams of the late 90s, as you write about Sammy Sosa.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the great things you realized, which is it's not just that they won, it's how they won, you know, which, and even this year losing, they just seem like they're hugely athletic, they're great infield and everything, but they also seem like they have, like, they really like each other, and they have a lot of fun playing baseball, and it's fun to watch them. When I followed them around with Sosa, there was incredible tension all the time, because basically, Sosa kind of lorded it over everybody, and it was a Sammy Sosa show. And in the locker room, there was just people that hated each other, and you felt it, and it made it an unpleasant work environment, you know?
You spend a lot of time, I hesitate to use the word reminiscing, about the game when you were a teenager going to the games. And I'm wondering if, even though they were losing at the time, is there something about that portion of your life that you miss?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, they were great. I mean, I thought for sure that team would win the World Series because I thought they were so great. I'm talking about the 84 Cubs. And it turns out every Cubs fan of any age had a team like that that broke their heart. It was like a rite of passage or losing your Cubs fan virginity in some way. So, you know, but that's where you really learn. There was always stuff going on in the bleachers and people teaching you stuff, and that's where you really learned to watch baseball. And the Cubs still were all day games, so they were the perfect for a kid. Because either you come home from school and watch them, they're on TV with Harry Carey announcing the game, or you could ditch school, which we did, and get on the train and go down for the baseball game, and you could see them and watch them in a way you couldn't watch any other professional team because their hours were like your hours, and it was like really a first taste of autonomy in adulthood was leaving home, getting on the train, and going to the Cubs game. Mm-hmm. It was almost like something my father describes about going to Ebbets Field when he was a kid. It's something that I think we were really lucky to have that Phil Wrigley gave us, and maybe not on purpose, maybe on purpose, which was this last taste of baseball like from the 1940s and 50s.
A neighborhood park.
A neighborhood park where it was your parents had no problem with you just going down there and hanging out after the game, and the players were kind of around, and they would sit. A lot of, like, used to, in the 90s, you can go to a bar across the street after the game, and Mark Grace would be in there drinking a beer.
What did your father do for a living?
Well, this is a big question. You know, my father was, he wrote a book when I was a kid called You Can Negotiate Anything. And he was so-called a professional negotiator. And he'd worked for the State Department and the Justice Department, and but really he was just kind of a wise guy from Brooklyn who took all the stuff he learned as a kid and kind of figured out a way to teach it, and that's sort of what he did.
Because he seemed to have access to some of these. He had access to Tommy Lasorda. He got you into games. He got you to meet people. How did that come about?
Well, my father's best friend when he was a kid and through his life was Larry King.
Uh-huh.
They kind of grew up together.
For those who might not know, Larry King was a big media personality. He's had a show on television for like 500 years.
Right.
Knows everybody.
And his real name is Larry Zeiger.
Uh-huh.
from Bensonhurst. And when he was a kid, his father died when he was a little kid. And he ended up kind of living at my parents' house a lot of the time.
Oh.
And they became very, very close. Larry, people don't remember, did a lot of sports stuff. He was, he broadcast about the NFL. He's a baseball nut. Like, they know everything about baseball. And so that was some of the way, which is my father met with, because they were both guests on Larry's show. And then they just became friendly. When Lasorda would come to Chicago, he'd invite him to the park. My father grew up with Sandy Koufax. They were all in high school together. And Fred Wilpon and all those guys. I went to Lafayette High School.
Lafayette, yeah. So my wife went to school.
Oh, yeah. So he knew them from kids, you know. So I met them when I was a kid. And then the one person that he kind of knew from that group that I read about in the book that I don't really understand how he met was Ernie Banks. Some way, somehow, just being in Chicago, I guess, he met Ernie Banks. They kind of bonded, and he became peers with Ernie Banks.
That is a great childhood to have in that regard. You know, Dad, who had
my dad's whole thing is like, they said I can't get in. Can I get in even though I'm not supposed to? That's something like stuff from Brooklyn when he was a kid.
Uh-huh.
You know, you always say to him like, "Oh, you can't." I would always say to him, "You can't get in there. You need a ticket." He's like, "I can't get in there. You can't get in there. You think I can't get in there?
Uh-huh.
I know you can't. There's a security guard. Just watch."
Uh-huh.
And then he would get in. And even up till a few years ago, so that was always his thing, was getting in places that they said he couldn't get in.
I'm sure.
And so we were always on the field behind the scenes, you know. And baseball games used to always find ways to get us into the locker room and stuff. And at one point, my dad was taking me to one of these games, and my brother was supposed to go. And I said, "Why aren't you going?" He goes, "Why? Because now I'm the same age as the players, and I feel stupid."
That always comes to a point. I mean, that's where I started to lose interest in the modern game, is when I realized that I had reached the age where there was no way I could get on a major league roster.
You know, yeah, well, that's
Jesse Orozco is pitching into his 40s. Phil Negro is pitching well into his 40s. And once I pass that, I figure, well, that's it. You know, I'm out.
I know that. I feel the same exact way. I actually wrote a story that began with that. It's like once you're older than the oldest players in the pros, it's completely different.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, my golden age was the 69 Mets. So when you write about Leo Durocher, you know, I've read a lot of books about the 69 Cubs and then their shortcomings. But one of the other things I wanted to ask you, is there an audio version of this book, or will there be?
There is.
There is?
It exists now, yeah.
Because as I'm reading this, I'm saying this is the kind of thing I would like to hear. You have a way of telling a story, and as you might think, I read a lot of baseball books. And many of them are very, you know, just the facts, ma'am, type thing. But yours is very personal, and it's told in a storytelling way, which makes it ideal for an audiobook, I think.
Yeah, well, it is. It's on Audible, and it exists. I can't listen to it, of course. It's like seeing yourself in the mirror or something. I just can't. I don't like it.
But are you the reader?
No. I actually read my last book, which was about the Rolling Stones, and it was so arduous, and there were so many words I was basically mispronouncing my whole life. I didn't realize I was mispronouncing. I'm like, I can't do that again.
Well, I'll have to look for that, and I would recommend it. Do you have a preference, you know, just being personally now, to eyes on the book versus ears on the book?
Well, there's some books, like you just said, some books are just great to listen to because they're written in a almost an oral kind of, you know, storytelling way. I like to think my book is like that. So it depends on the book. Like lately, I've been listening. There's an audio version of Garrison Keillor reading Huckleberry Finn, and it's like the greatest thing in the world.
Well, it also helps to have a great voice reading it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like anything David McCullough would read, yeah, he could read the phone book, as the expression goes, and I would love to hear it.
Right, and there's a few audio guys who only know from reading audiobooks, but I'll go look up what other books they've read because I love hearing their voice so much.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, we've been talking with Rich Cohen, author of The Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse. And, Rich, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today, and continued good luck with this book and whatever you're doing next.
Thanks. Great talking.
And that was our conversation with Rich Cohen, one of the many conversations we'll be having in the weeks and months to come, I'm hoping. In the meantime, if you have any suggestions about books you'd like to hear about and authors you'd like to hear from, please contact me at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. And of course, don't forget to visit the site, ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf.com, and check out my own books. I have a few of my own. We're working on some things for the near future, I hope. 501 Baseball Bookshelf. I can't remember the name of my own book. Let's try that again. 501 Baseball Books Fans Must Read Before They Die, published originally in 2013, and hoping to have a new edition coming out in the not-too-distant future. And the latest baseball book is Hank Greenberg in 1938, Hatred and Home Runs in the Shadow of War. This year marks the 80th anniversary of his season in which he challenged Babe Ruth's single-season home run record amidst everything else that was going on at the time. So I hope you'll check those out. They're available at Amazon. Can't imagine they'd be at your local bookseller these days unless you ask them to order it. So hope you check those out. And again, thanks for listening to the bookshelf conversation, the baseball bookshelf conversation, or where I'm calling it these days. I have to look that up because, like I say, it's been a while. So thanks again, everybody. Continued good reading. The season is about to start in a few weeks, so hope you enjoy. Take care. See you next time. Pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land."